Of all the watches I see in this line of work, there are none that make me smile quite like those from MB&F. I don't even know exactly what it is about them, but I can't seem to look at one without grinning. MB&F is short for Maximilian Bucer and Friends, and the brand's founder, Mr. Max Bucer himself, is somehow even more charming and interesting than the watches he and his collaborators create. After a childhood of sketching cars and a few years at Swiss engineering school, he serendipitously ended up working at Jaeger-LeCoultre before going on to launch the famous Opus program at Harry Winston, essentially kicking off the modern era of high-concept independent watchmaking altogether. Now, I've known Max for years, and he's one of those people who makes you want to lean in closer when he speaks. There's an understatement and a humility to him that you might not expect from his sometimes brash creations. Ahead of Hodinkee 10, I had the chance to sit down with Max and Hodinkee senior writer James Stacey to talk about how Max ended up in this weird little world of ours and how, with a little creativity and passion, he's trying to make it just that little bit weirder. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. Cool. Thanks so much for joining us, Max. It's good to have you here.
Great pleasure.
And we've got James Stacey here, too.
Hey, everyone.
It's Thursday morning on the eve of H10.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think we can say, is kind of the first sort of like H10 peripheral thing we're officially doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad way to kick things off.
No, this is great.
So, Max, I think a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with you and your company, MB&F. But can you give us a little bit of your background? You have not the most traditional kind of Swiss watch industry background of any company proprietor out there.
I don't know where to start or usually these stories. I'm an engineer by training. I did the OPFL in Lausanne. And my first job 27 years ago was at Jaeger-LeCoultre as a product manager. I actually owe everything I have done in my life today to Henri-John Belmont, the then CEO of Jaeger, who probably saw in me things I didn't see in myself. And so he coerced me into joining because nobody wanted to work in the watch industry in those days. Everybody around me when I signed was thought, are you insane? And so 7 years at Jaeger, incredible years. This is a pre-Richemont era, which is an era where the best retailers in the world would tell me, young man, that watch which turns has no future. Why the hell are you actually producing it? And after those 7 years, I was headhunted at Harry Winston to head their timepiece division, which should have been the most beautiful day of my professional life and turned out to be the biggest nightmare of my professional life because I was 31. I probably had no idea what I was getting into, but more importantly, I had no idea that Harry Winston timepieces was virtually bankrupt.
And actually, it's a pretty important detail.
It's more than a little detail. Yeah. And then I think it was a week later, I discovered that Harry Winston, the brand, was being put on sale for many different reasons. And so I remember I when I finally officially entered the company, I jumped on a plane, went to New York and told my new bosses it's a nightmare. And they all looked at me and said, yeah, it's your nightmare. We've got other things to deal with.
That's exactly what you want to hear from your new bosses.
Gosh, I thought I'd done the biggest error of my life. And it took us, 98, 99, which were the most horrible years of my life, with a little team which I had inherited, which they all wanted to leave the company. I was like trying to keep them in. We took us about a year and a half to stabilize what was happening there. And then from 2000 to 2005, we grew that company in an incredible way. Actually, when I think about it, we went from, I think, about $8 to $80 million, which in those days was very substantial.
Incredible. That's 10x. That's not insubstantial today.
It was actually, I discovered that I was actually capable of doing that. You have no idea. You have no idea what you're capable of till you're actually confronted to it. And I discovered as the company was growing that I was less and less enjoying myself, which was more than weird. I come from a middle class, no money family. I never, ever imagined I would have that sort of job. and have my face in the newspapers and get that sort of money. And I sort of felt guilty because you're not allowed to be ungrateful. You're not allowed to be unhappy when you get to that position. But I was. And then a lot of things happened in my life. I usually quote the most important one, which was my dad passing away. And from there on, I went into therapy, which for you guys in the US is normal. But when you're Swiss, it's not normal at all. And that was quite a jump for me. And it was an eye-opener. And that sort of, that during those That therapy is when I understood that I had to create my own company. Hence, 2005, I resigned just after Basel 2005, which we launched the incredible Opus 5 with Felix and Martin. And they let me go, I think, on the 15th of July 2005. And the 25th, I incorporate MBNF, which is just like me working from my flat for the next 2 years.
There weren't too many friends in
there were a lot of friends, but not internally. Yeah. There were a ton of, I mean, all these people around me which made it possible.
Yeah.
And then it's been up and down. I mean, we've had some great years. We've had some super rough years. But 13, soon 14 years later, wow. And 15 calibers later, We're having a ball. It's incredible. The last 3-4 years have been incredible.
I love the idea of counting time in calibers. It's such a it makes total sense to me. Like you say that, and you know, you're nodding along as well, James.
Yeah, for sure.
But it really I think speaks to the way in which this industry moves at kind of its own special pace, and with its own kind of little mile markers, right?
Well, the whole point of creating a company like ours is to create. So what do you create? You create beautiful movements. That is the point. And hence, I actually don't even think of years. I think of calibers. It's how many calibers we've managed to create and how many calibers we've got in the pipeline. That's my cursor, which tells me where I am in my life.
Can you say how many are in the pipeline right now?
Seven.
Okay.
Seven. Wow. We're taking us to about 23 or 24. Super frustrating, of course.
I'm sure.
I mean, if I was a painter and I woke up in the morning and I had an idea and I start painting, and maybe except if I'm Rembrandt, who took a little bit longer, but I mean, it would take me 2-3 weeks. I have an idea. I have to wait 3.5 to 4 years before I see the baby come out. And hence, it has a big impact on the way I live this whole process, because the whole interest for me is the creative process. Is seeing that initial sketch become reality. When it does, I lose complete interest in it. So we get into this very weird situation where we launch a product. The first week I launch it is very exhilarating. And even though with the internet, they've robbed me of all my wow moments, because I get that like 10-minute wow effect when I present the first day. Usually we do launch it in Singapore, in front of a group of 50, 60 MBNF aficionados, and you unveil the piece and they're like, whoa! And then the next morning, everybody's like, yeah, I've already seen it. So that moment, that sort of week when you unveil it and you present it, is an incredible reward, even though I don't do it for that, but it's you get the love. And then afterwards, then you're presenting something, you've lost complete interest in it. I'm not saying it's not a great product. It's an incredible piece. But then I just shift my focus onto the next 6-7 calibers, because they're the ones which get my adrenaline up. The producing, the marketing, the selling is a necessary evil.
The fact that the product has to become a product.
Exactly. Once the product has been created and it's working and it's exactly what you, well, it's not always exactly, but it's more or less exactly what you had in mind, that's the love. And then all the other process, which is necessary because we need to fund the next calibers, that's okay. A man got to do what a man got to do.
Sure. So I think it's something that you hear from artists, from creators, that like, you know, yeah, they're in it because they wanted to create something, not because they saw the business model and worked backwards. I don't think you get to your product by starting backwards from business. Nobody could get there.
Exactly.
You wouldn't make the pyramids if you decided to monetize it and then work backwards to making something like that. You would never get there.
Look at the Eiffel Tower.
It has to start because something you want. Yeah.
Look at the Eiffel Tower. They created specifically for the expo, and it was going to be dismantled at the end of the expo. Luckily for Paris, they didn't dismantle it.
Right.
But I mean, all these, anything which is really, I hate the word disruptive because everybody uses it, but really different, is usually created definitely not on a business model. And it's more some, what was it in the book, The Fountainhead? Ayn Rand writes, ego is the fountainhead of human creativity or something like that. It's like you do what you believe in and then you find means to finance it.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the other side of that is that you do what you believe in, and if the output is good, even if you disconnect from it once it becomes output, then it takes on its next life as a product, which allows you to make your next 6-7 calibers. And there's a certain beauty, like we were talking before we started recording, we were chatting about the Lamborghini Miura, and that was essentially a pet project of a few people at Lamborghini that were essentially being told not to do it at some level. And of course, what they designed, what they created, was one of the most beautiful cars ever made. I think that's an easy statement, but also defined a genre that exists today as the peak still of something that people don't need, a supercar with an engine in the back and a tiny cockpit that's not that easy to drive and you can't see out of and all these things, but it's a beautiful thing. And my guess is they made it and they were happy with how it looked and everything, and then what it's become now, an Aventador or a Huracan or something, isn't entirely, that's almost a mass commodity compared to what they were creating in 65, 66.
In those days, engineers were artists.
Absolutely.
There were no CFOs. There was no CMOs to dictate them what they should do. There was no data to sustain that what they were doing was actually probably better or worse. Mm-hmm. They were definitely not going to do any marketing reviews to ask the clients if they liked it.
Yeah.
And that's how these insanely beautiful and disruptive creations changed the world. You just can't create something really innovative by counting beans and asking people what they want.
Yeah. I think, we keep going back and forth as we talk about this, about, the idea of engineers being one way and artists and designers being another way. But I think one of the things that's fascinating about you and the business you've created is, by necessity, you have to be doing both together. You have to be a sort of engineer artist. And your background, I think most people would assume that you went to design school or that you're an artist by training when they look at the products. But how do you think approaching this with a sort of classical engineering training affects how you design and create?
Well, for a very long time, I had actually a chip on my shoulder that I was not a watchmaker. I was an engineer. Mm. So I'll start with that. And I realize today that by not being a watchmaker and being an engineer and understanding metal, understanding how everything functions together, but not having the rules dictated to me, has actually allowed me to create pieces I would never have thought of. Take the Legacy machine. Why has nobody before us created a flying or suspended balance wheel? It's so beautiful. It's so mesmerizing. Why hasn't anybody thought about it? And I, for a very long time, I actually wondered, how come? What have I missed? Now, clearly, engineering-wise, it was super complicated. Watchmaking, we're talking of an 18,000 oscillations an hour. We're talking of something which is very complex to regulate. You need great watchmakers. And of course, that's we've strayed, at least industrial watchmaking has strayed from that. But still, I mean, somebody else should have thought about that. And then I realized, as a watchmaker, you have to protect the heart of your movement. You have to protect it, have it in the movement. And if somebody comes to you and says, why don't we take it out of the movement and suspend it? You will go, no way. Because that's what you've been taught. You have to protect the regulator. And by not being a watchmaker, I was able to do that. But now, one step back. If I'd only been a designer, a creator, an artist, which, by the way, I have no formal training in that, I really am a diehard engineer, probably not a very good one, but I am an engineer. I would probably have never created what I did because I would be hitting walls all the time. I would create stuff I would think super cool, and then all the engineers would tell me it's not possible. And we would lose hundreds and thousands of hours debating on why is it not possible and etc. Now when we debate, I speak the same language as them. It's been going on for 27 years. Whenever I have an idea, I know that 50 to 80% is possible. Now I have to find the people who are way more competent than me in engineering who can bring that 20 to 50% which is missing.
Okay.
But I can actually sit down with them and debate. If there is no that, probably 80% of our creations would not exist.
And that's something that's always been super key for MBNF, right? Is this idea that it's not a huge bloated corporate structure where you have, you know, 20 million layers of middle management like most watch companies and large conglomerates of all kinds do, but that you're talking to the watchmakers, you're talking to, you know, your team directly and kind of solving problems one-on-one. And I would assume that that requires that you have that level of understanding. Like somebody who didn't have that training couldn't run a company structured like MBNF, right?
It's really important that I have that training, but it's also very important to acknowledge what I'm not good at. Mm. I think as an entrepreneur and a creator, it's as important to know what you're good at as what you're really not good at. And therefore to surround yourself with people who are way better than you. And that's what I've been doing initially with everybody around me when I was just alone in my flat for 2 years. And then now we're 26 in the company. I always said we'd never be more than 15. Wow. So I'm a little bit, we're a bit more than what I expected. But everybody is better than me in what they do. Otherwise, this doesn't exist. And you just have to put your ego aside. Otherwise, it just doesn't happen.
So I want to go back to the beginning of the story you started telling us at the beginning of this episode. So you come out of engineering school, and you somehow end up at JLC.
Yeah.
How did you even end up on their doorstep, let alone possibly... Because you had no intention of going into watchmaking, right?
No. Okay, I'll do a quick summary. I had absolutely no link to watchmaking. My dad was working for Nestle, a big conglomerate, technical sales engineer, whatever he was. And I actually fell into watchmaking the very first time because at 18, my parents wanted to give me a watch, which is what happens in Switzerland, even in those days. And so they gave me a budget, which was 700 francs, which was an enormous amount of money for me and for them. And so I started looking around, went to stores to see what I could get for that sort of money, because I was absolutely not into watches. And one day I'm sitting next to a guy in university, and I say, so what are you wearing? And the guy says, a Rolex. I'm like, what's a Rolex? That's the extent of my passion for watchmaking when I'm 18 years old. And he starts explaining, and I'm intrigued, and I ask him, so what's the price? And he tells me, 4,700 francs. Remember, I had 700 francs.
A little above your budget, yeah.
And I went berserk on this poor guy. I insulted him. I'm like, this is what I used to make by being a cinema usher, like two, three evenings a week, by selling hi-fi on Saturdays, by doing maths courses during lunch breaks. That's probably what I made in a year. And this guy was wearing it, and plus with antiquated technology on his wrist. Now we're talking of 1985.
Okay.
So a few years later, there's a project in my engineering school which is all about engineering and sociology, and I chose to sort of discover why people would pay these insane amounts of money for something which was antiquated technology, and I sent letters out to the big brands. And in those days, those big brands were so small. I think in those days, like Breguet was doing 600 watches a year and Vacheron 700 watches a year. And that me, a little student from a local university, gets a letter back from the CEOs of each company.
Not bad.
That it's insane when you think of it today. That's the extent of how small that industry had become. Saying, well, young man, if you come at this hour, that day, I'll give you 1 hour. So I met... I met Steve Urquhart at AP, Claude Daniel Prolox at VC, Gerald Genta himself, Henri John Belmont at Jaeger LeCoultre, Henri, what was his name? Mr. Baudet at Breguet. And so there I am. I'm going to interview them and like explain to me why.
And how old are you when this is happening?
I'm probably about 20, 21.
Okay.
Yeah. And they all more or less tell me the same thing. We know what we do is pointless, but it's so beautiful. And for me, it was a shock because engineering college in those days, at least in Switzerland, the notion of beauty never, ever was even factored anywhere. Is you have to be efficient. We're Swiss, we're engineers, we have to be efficient. and so this whole sort of beauty, which became something emotional, so I was already amazed. And then they came up with, and you do realize that if we do go down and we don't survive this era, generations of artisans are going to disappear. People who have given from father to son the tricks of how to do a Breguet curve on a spiral and how to angle that that angle, etc., etc. All that knowledge is going to disappear. And that's another world premiere for me. It was somebody talking about humanity. There is no, oh, at least there was no humanity in my engineering studies. And I actually felt completely in love with it. And then I went to do my military service. That's what we do when we're Swiss. And had an absolutely horrible accident. I shouldn't be here. I mean, there is no reason I should be alive after that accident. And after 6 weeks in hospital, and I don't know, like 6 weeks at home in a cast, complete with my whole upper body in a cast. Luckily for me, my left hand, my left arm was free. I actually jumped on a bus and went up to the center of Lausanne, where I used to live. And I had, in my mind, for a year, I'd been seeing that Abel chronograph with the Primero movement in steel. Everybody was buying the golden steel in those days, and it was just all in steel. And I go to the store and I say, I'm completely in my cast. You can imagine the thing. This youngster comes completely in a cast coming in and says, I want that watch. And she gives me the price. And I buy it, and she puts it on my wrist, and I go back in the bus, and I'm screaming in the bus. I got my watch. So that's how I realized I was completely hooked, but didn't mean at all I was going to work in that industry, because nobody wanted to work in that industry. It was dying. It Right. didn't make any sense to go and work Right. there. And then so the story, which is completely true and which is completely insane, is that I think in January 91, just at the end of my studies, because I actually did my military service in the middle of my study, the end of my studies, and then I still had my diploma. I'm skiing with some friends in Verbier in Switzerland, and we stop at a cafe, and then there's Henri John Belmont with his family, and oh, hello, how are you? You want to have a coffee? I'm like, yeah, sure. And we talk. He asks me what I'm going to do, and I'm interviewing with Procter & Gamble, with Nestle, and at the end, as a joke, I tell him, well, Mr. Belmont, if P&G doesn't give me the job, you can always give me a job at Jaeger. And he laughs, I laugh, and that's it. I mean, imagine if I hadn't said that. And imagine if I hadn't been skiing that day. And a week later, he has me called up, and would you go and see Mr. Belmont at the Valley Jew? I said, yeah, sure. So I go into my little old beaten up Opel Corsa. You don't know what an Opel Corsa, you don't want to know. and I drive up to the Valley Jew, and it's the interview of my life. Henri John, the man who's going to save Jaeger with Günter Blümlein, interviews me for 3 hours without asking me a question. He takes me through the factory, which is derelict, and says, this is what we're going to do. This is what I'm going to do. And then he shows me the products and like, okay, well, this is what there is today, but we're going to do the géographique and the grand réveil, and we're going to do a bigger reversal, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And I'm just listening. And the end of 3 hours, he more or less says, okay, you've got the job. I'm like, what? he says, I need a young engineer like you who's passionate about watches to help me, because I'm going to create a job as product manager. You're going to develop all the movements and the watches with me. I think I still remember that moment. It was 27 years ago. I was in awe, but at the same time, there was like the cerebral part kicking in, going, whoa, 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 this is all great and romantic, but what am I doing? So I said, look, I have to think about it, because I think Nestle was like 7 interviews and I was in the 3rd or the 4th, and it would take months to get there.
Slightly different process.
It definitely is slightly different. Very different process. And he just looked at me, and I often quote this, what he said to me, and that's why I said, in many ways, he changed, completely saved my life, actually. He said, young man, you have to know one thing in your life. Do you want to be one amongst 200,000 people in a big corporation, or do you want to be one amongst the 3 or 4 of us who are going to save Jaeger? Just think about that.
Good sales pitch.
Yeah, that's a pretty good pitch.
That's a good
right
recruiter.
Yeah.
Best sales pitch in history. And the next morning I called him up and I said, okay, that's going to change my life. I owe him everything.
And he did.
Yeah.
So the watch that you got from your parents was the Ebel chronograph?
No, no. Oh, no, I can't talk about that one. I bought a Tissot quartz watch.
Okay.
Golden steel. Oh, my gosh. I look at it from time to time and I take it out of the safe and I'm like, ah. But you know what? It's part of the journey.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I tell all collectors, because a lot of them say, oh, my gosh, I'm going to sell this. And why did I buy that? When you bought it, it was the best piece ever. Yeah. Don't forget that. And you were that person who thought it was the best piece. So when you look at your collection of watches 30 years down the road, you'll probably not wear half of them, but that's the man or the woman you wear. And that's important.
Yeah. I have a mundane Swiss Railway watch, 38 millimeters, quartz, big date, that I got for my high school graduation from my grandmother. And I got it because I had a teacher in high school who was really into clothes and style, who had one, and told me he thought it was the coolest design you could get for that kind of money. And I got one, and I wore it, I think, probably every day for 4 or 5 years till I, started getting into vintage watches and bought a vintage watch. But I still have it. I haven't worn it in forever, but mm-hmm. I have it. It sits with all my other watches.
The Mondaine Railway watch is a design icon.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Absolutely.
It is.
Yeah, and it's, what was it? James, do you have a watch that kind of fills that role for you?
Oh, like an early one that's probably semi-embarrassing. I mean, my name's not that embarrassing.
No, not even embarrassing.
I can blow you guys out of the water. Like, so a handful of the first watches I bought were Invictas.
Oh, nice.
I didn't know that they were gaming Rolex. I bought one that looked just like a two-tone sub. I bought one that looked just like a Daytona. And then like 6 months later, this is kind of like when I got into watches before Hodinkee, before Blog to Watch, before there was like anyone like making a business out of writing about watches online. So there was like a Watch Report, which ended up being the first one that I wrote for.
Yeah,
maybe a year later. And you start, and I bought a couple of those Invictas, like $80. Remarkable what they can make for $80, but it's somebody else's design. And then 6 months later, I've read everything I can find online about watches, and you realize, like, okay, well, I can't wear this. This is like, it might as well be a fake. They just changed the name on it. And then you do what everybody does. You find Seiko.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just one of the most impressive businesses in the world. What they can, again, create at $60, $70, $40. I mean, I think some of them were $40 that I bought some of the Seiko 5s. And then you can go up to $40,000, $50,000 more.
Yeah.
Essentially from roughly the same people.
It's incredible value for money. I mean, from a normal Seiko to... I'm so happy that people are finally waking up to Grand Seiko.
Oh yeah.
For years, they were hindered by the fact that there was that word Seiko. Mm-hmm. But it's... I shouldn't be saying this, but it's honestly one of the best values for money ever.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, you say you shouldn't be saying this. I mean, we find that whenever we're in Switzerland, there's inevitably somebody on our team wearing a Seiko or Grand Seiko or something. And the looks you get from people, it's like you're a traitor, that you could wear a Japanese watch in Switzerland. Do you find that feeling is still there?
No, what I do see is that, unfortunately, in watch brands, there are very few people who like watches now. And that's what actually resumes the issue of our industry.
Is it just business creating more business?
They've got all their own reasons, but they actually don't like watchmaking. They don't like watches. They don't appreciate it. They've got their own personal reasons to be there. It's a very successful industry today. It's a powerful industry. It gives a lot of ego. It's people feel good when they're there, but mostly for the wrong reasons. And it's interesting. I just hired a brilliant young man from one of the groups. I will not say which brand and which group. And I called him the day after he resigned. I said, so how did it go? And he said, you know what? I was already so happy I signed on with you guys, but now I'm even happier. And I'm like, why? He said, because 80% of my colleagues have never heard of MBNF. And I don't say that
everybody... James is just sitting here shaking his head, just baffled.
I don't think that everybody should know who we are. But I mean, if you're working in a beautiful high-end brand, you should at least have heard about us or heard about Uhrwerk or De Betune or Kari or Grunefels. I mean, you should know a little bit of that.
Yeah, you should
but
know the
landscape.
But
that's the state of our industry today.
Yeah. Just blinders, their product.
Not interested. Not interested.
That's so baffling. I mean, speaking of those brands you just mentioned, I do want to make sure we give some time to Opus. You know, I think Opus is one of those programs that for people in the industry, people like the three of us, it has this kind of like mythic status. And I think, you know, when it was in its heyday, consumers really knew about it. But I wonder if some of the people listening might not fully understand the scope of Opus. So you're at JLC. You're there for, what, about eight?
7 years.
7 years. Mm-hmm. And then make the move to Harry Winston,
Yeah. Kind
of stabilize that business. And then you launch Opus. Can you tell us what Opus is, how the idea came about? Kind of give us the Opus 101 class.
It's interesting how, looking back, between the perception the world has of it and the reasons why it was created, there's such a difference. When I entered Harry Winston, I remember telling Mr. Winston, Ronald Winston, who was a wonderful gentleman, said, look, you're one of the greatest, if not the greatest in those days, jeweler in the world. Your watches are just not up to the standards. I mean, your watches have to be amongst the greatest watches. So he said, okay, what are we going to do? I said, we're not a manufacturer. We're not watchmakers. We don't have 250 years of history. We don't make our own movements, etc. It's all the don'ts were there.
Right.
Now, what are we? And I sort of boiled it down to, let's say we're rare timepieces. Actually, just because nobody could find them anyway, because nobody wanted them. So we basically said rare. That becomes an asset. And so it was rare diamonds and rare movements. So the rare diamonds was a no-brainer, where Harry Winston. And the rare movements was not a no-brainer. And that's where I had to go start hunting. And one of the things I also have to thank Mr. Winston for was when he hired me, I said, I'm not going to join this company if it's only to do a diamond set quartz watches. I'm not interested in that. We have to create great movements, great product, because otherwise I have no point in being here. And he said, oh, go for it. So then I started hunting. Let's not forget, I came from Jaeger, where we did everything ourselves. So I had virtually no network. We were like a little island where we just did everything ourselves. So I didn't know all the great watchmakers out there. And so I started going around and knocking on doors. Hello, I'm Max from Harry Winston, and we're trying to do great watches, and could you help us out? And in the middle of all that, by chance, and actually not by knocking on his door, I met François Poljean. And I remember Basel 2000, he launched his brand for the first time in Basel, at least. And we had dinner that week like three times together amongst other guys. And at some point, François Paul was telling me, it's difficult because people come, they see the product, they like it. But let's not forget, we're talking of 18 years ago. Independent watchmaking was just one showcase at the academy for most of the creators. It didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so he's the first one virtually who really created a brand de facto. And you say, well, people come and they ask me, what have you done? Who are you? Why should we give you your money? And he signed NDAs with every single company he'd worked for, with all the different creations he'd done for them. So basically, last day of the fair, he's telling me this while we're walking down from hall 1-1 to hall 1-0, actually on the escalator. And I sort of go, well, why don't we do a product together? Because I haven't signed the NDA. So I can tell the world how brilliant you are. We, Harry Winston, can tell the world François Poljean is incredible because. And he's like, okay, well, why not? And that's how it all started. So it's interesting that by trying to help a friend, we created something which is, in a way, has been a little bit of a game changer. And I totally, utterly believe in karma. I'm actually an atheist, but I completely believe in karma. And that's just one of the many, many, many examples of things that have happened to me in my life, of by trying to help people or trying to do good, actually something great happened. Probably not just because of that. It works.
Yeah. I mean, I think a few things you mentioned, people today might not fully understand if they're not kind of marinating in the industry all the time, which is, in 2000, you said there was no independent watchmaking. Like, nope. The idea of people like MB&F and Ervirk and François-Paul Jorn didn't exist. That just wasn't the landscape at all. And I think it's so much of what enthusiasts today, even if they're not buying those watches, still find exciting and exhilarating about the watch industry and the watch world. And I think it's been a big part in propping up the bigger brands as well, because it's just breathed so much excitement into the industry, and it's forced some of the established players to maybe think a little bit differently and to be a little more creative, maybe.
Do you think so? Really?
I think so. I think to compete, right? I think there's got to be some energy that rubs off.
I hope it has. I hope that whatever we independents who are creating... And it's true that, I mean, if you look at most of the innovation and the creativity and the ideas, I'm not talking of fundamental research. I'm talking of real artistic creativity. Watchmaking creativity comes very much, I find, from my friends and colleagues. But I'm actually not sure that the industry is going down that road, the big players. A few are trying, but...
I think a lot are evident of the kind of apathy or disinterest that you mentioned earlier. At least you can see it breathed into the most common kind of commodity level of their product. But what I think is so special, and I think, like, if you need an example, like, if what I'm about to say doesn't make sense to you when you hear it, go into a Mad Gallery, and I think it makes sense, because that's such a special place, and it's just pure enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
Four walls just cased in things that like have no other purpose except the way that they make you feel, and the way that should make you feel is like wonder and like whimsy and curiosity, and all of that just breathes enthusiasm. And I think that's what you get from these brands that were just kind of on the cusp of hitting enthusiasts, say 18 years ago.
And can I think, you, just for people who may not know, can you say what a Mad Gallery is?
Yeah, so the Mad Gallery is a showcase. Is it three now or four?
We just opened the fourth one.
Fourth one now.
Congratulations.
Okay. Very cool. And so I've been to the one in Geneva. Every time I get to Geneva, I don't love Geneva, especially because we're always there in January. It's very cold, right? But I do love going there. And then around the corner, there's the place that does the Princess Almonds. The
yes.
Orange
Hour.
Hour. Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. So that's the little 1-2 punch of that part of Geneva, as you spend an afternoon. And then, of course, across the street is Davidoff's, which is a great, such a best spot to be in Geneva. But the Mad Gallery is a collection of various mechanical and artistic oddities, I suppose, that have been curated at a very high level, generally for the gallery.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically a gallery which is only for kinetic and mechanical art. When I started out with MB&F and I was only doing horological machines, most of the watch retailers looked at me and go, well, that's not a watch, which in a way was a compliment. I was really happy. but then I thought at some point, maybe they're right. I should actually be featured in art galleries or MB&F pieces. So I went to art galleries and they just looked at me blankly and said, this is a watch. So clearly, so something was not working out here. And from there, the idea emerged that if we actually bring together, like we've often done with the independents, if we bring together people, like-minded creators, but in different segments, not in watchmaking, but mechanical art, we call it, and we showcase it and make people understand that, maybe they'll understand better what we're trying to do. And we were so clueless when we opened the first one. I mean, we didn't even have a credit card machine, didn't even know where to find one. it was...
The business model comes later.
It's like we did this, and really, I mean, my team was looking at me. Nobody had ever done retail, me included, ever. We were so clueless. And I remember I was so proud. We'd managed to get Shikara Nagata's motorcycle. Shikara is created five motorcycles in 18 years. They're all totally unique, of course. He buys, he finds very, very rare vintage engines, and then he by hand makes every single part around it. It takes him 3 to 4 years, and he'd never sold one. And I went to Japan to meet him. It was just that was one of the greatest meetings in my lifetime. And he actually accepted to have them come over. Well, he actually came with them because he never leaves his babies. And we're showcasing those bikes, and people are coming in, and they're jaws were dropping open. And yeah, sure, you can go and buy a great Ducati, Harley, BMW, whatever you want for probably 20 grand. It'll be way more efficient than a Shikara Nagata, which costs probably about $370,000. But it's 3 to 4 years of the life of a genius, of a man who's given everything for his art. Who, when I met him in Japan the first time, he actually told me, it was an amazing moment, where he told me through translator that his wife had left him and he had no more friends, but he couldn't stop doing what he was doing. Those are moments in your life which you'll always remember. And every time I see a Nagata, I'm like, I think of that phrase. So when you look at that, maybe you will understand what we're trying to do. And it started that way. That's how the Mad Gallery concept happened. And it snowballed without any marketing dollars or anything. It's just word of mouth. And then we opened one with a local partner in Taipei, and then one in Dubai, and we opened one in Hong Kong. And I'm still amazed. I'm not very often amazed by what happens to us.
I absolutely adore the gallery. I couldn't recommend it enough. If you're in Switzerland, go to Geneva, even just to go to the gallery. It's just super fun. Every time I'm in there, there's something I haven't seen before. It always kind of has, but it has the same like spirit or soul in the room. And a lot of it comes through these like eccentric products and beautiful displays. And it's just like, I mean, it's not a huge space, but I can spend a lot of time just like, you can get really close to stuff and yeah. There's a lot of detail there. And some of the moving sculptures, there was one that was kind of like wheat moving in the wind. I that mesmerized me. Like I stood there like a 3-year-old, like just staring at this thing as it get, like light comes back and forth across these kind of like long reeds.
Right.
I don't remember what it was called, but it was stunning.
It's the Inaho by a Japanese artist who's based in London. So we curate these incredible mm-hmm. pieces, which usually are, most of the artists we curate can't barely make ends meet because traditional galleries are not interested in that. And so I think also there's a moment in my life now where I was probably a very self-centered young man at some point where I was trying to survive and to grow and to become. And now, after hitting 50, I think I feel so happy to help other people who've got talent, which has already happened with Opus. It started off with that. Then MBNF, of course, we credit every single person who's worked on the project. We try and act as much as we can as a communication base for their talent. And because without them, my ideas would just stay ideas. That you have to have the humility to understand that you're just nothing. I just have ideas, which are weird ideas, quirky ideas, different ideas. I used to be a kid who didn't fit in. I was the weird one. I was the geek. I mean, I had a Commodore 64 as my best friend. You probably don't know what a Commodore 64 is.
We're both pretty big nerds. I think we both know what a Commodore 64 is.
And so I realized later on in life, being different, being the weird one is okay. I think it's probably one of the biggest realizations. And then afterwards you realize that whatever you think you are, whoever you think you are, you're nothing without everybody around you. And that's how it happened. Opus, MBNF, the Mad Gallery, everything else you're going to see is a step in that direction.
Yeah, I think it's funny that you say your best friend was a Commodore 64. I think the perception, both in the industry and kind of outwardly, is that you're a community builder. I mean, that's what you do from Opus to MBNF to the Mad Gallery. It's always about other people, and it's about bringing people together and collaborating and kind of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts. How did you kind of arrive at that as your, I guess, like modus operandi, I guess?
Huh. It's probably... because I suffered very long as a child of being lonely, and I'm an only child, and my parents didn't really interact much with me, and it's very tough for a youngster and a teenager specifically to be shunned and not to have friends. It's a disaster, and it gives a very it harms you so much that it sticks with you for a very long time. And we actually arrived at college, and my parents moved into town. We were out in the countryside before, and they started traveling. And I sort of intuitively started becoming like the guy who was organizing stuff and helping everybody. And I was the organizer. And everybody was happy to have an organizer do the stuff for them. Suddenly I felt appreciated. Suddenly I felt useful. And it made me happy. And I think it just took over from there, that I realized that helping other people and bringing people together made that people suddenly recognized me, because I had such a low self-esteem. And I think I'm talking while I'm thinking. I think that's what more or less brought this on now, while I'm talking to you guys.
Yeah. I think it's another case of something we've talked about, which is like, it doesn't sound like this was like a business model from the beginning, that you said, you know, if I bring a whole bunch of smart people together, I can make a lot of money or make a successful business. It was just kind of how you went about doing things. And it seems like it's worked, I guess.
I think MBNF is really an emanation from my most basic neurosis. I actually only realized later on why I'd called the brand Unfriends, because I was that little kid who was craving to have friends. When I did it, it just came naturally. And everybody told me, this is the worst, lamest name ever for a watch brand. I mean, you can't call a high-end, complicated watch brand Unfriends. And even today, actually, it's interesting. I had one of our best retailers the other day say, like, can you please stop with this stupid name? Nobody knows what it means, MBNF. And it's true. It's interesting. But because us in the community, we and I'm very proud of being a geek. So I hold the flag of the geek people. We know that MBNF stands for Max Busso, Maximilian Busso and Friends. But people now are discovering the brand. They're like, who's this F guy? Francis, Fabian, who's this?
And
I'm like,
what? Yeah.
Yeah, like, what? And then you realize, and that's that retailer was right. He was like, we have to explain this to people. Well, when you start explaining, you've already lost them. Yeah, it has to be easier. In marketing terms, he's right. But he's like, just call it Maximilian Busso and get over with it. And I'm like, no. But actually, for the anecdote, which is, if I find a funny anecdote, the brand was not supposed to be called MBNF. It was supposed to be called BNF. Every single first drawings I did, I'd written B and F, Busso and Friends. And then when I decided I was actually going to create the brand, I went to the trademark attorneys and said, okay, I was still working in Harry Winston. Can I trademark this? And they all went like, oh, no way. I'm like, why? Bell and Ross. Bell and Ross had registered BNR everywhere.
Sure.
And of course, they would have not been very happy that a new brand comes out called BNF. So they're like, you're going to go into a wall before you even start, and with everybody hitting on you legally. I was like, oh, shoot. So I actually added the M, which I still today don't feel comfortable with, because it sort of makes that I'm more important than the friends, because I've got two letters instead of one. And I still today would prefer to be calling it BNF, but hey,
you know, I think, you know, you said a moment ago, once you have to start explaining it to customers, you lose the customer. One of the things that's always impressed me about your products, and if you do a search of Hodinkee, you can probably find that I'm sometimes a very lazy writer and I fall back on the same trope over and over again. But it really with MBNF, I always have the same thought when I see the new product, which is, this thing just puts a smile on my face. Yeah. I don't think I've been familiar with the brand for probably 6 or 7 years now, and I don't think once I've had either you or Harris or somebody show me a product and not just grinned like a little boy. Like, it's, they don't require any explanation for me, and you know, explanation can sometimes make them better and you appreciate the technical nuances, but there's something really unique about the products and the way they do make you feel something in a way that I think a lot of watches don't.
Yeah, and the other thing I would add is the more that you're telling some of your backstory, the more I can see that exact story in the designs, in the product. You had mentioned that like you've spent time finding people who do better at things than where your weaknesses are. You found strengths, and you see that in the Friends product, in the Friends side of the whole equation, is finding people that have these defined excellent traits and bringing them into what you're very good at and what you're capable of doing. And you see that all kind of layered in, and then you know, you say that you hold the flag for the geeks, and of course, like, there's a defined kind of neo-futurism that kind of traces a line through some of the product, and then of course the clocks and all that kind of thing. So you can see a Commodore 64 thread in some of the work that goes on, some of the design. So the fascination with, you know, pre-future stuff, and I think it's really fascinating to hear the story, having already known so many of the products, and to see how that, I don't know, like, that you want to talk an overused term like DNA, but how that there is like a DNA there that makes sense.
I call it more my biography.
There you go.
I like that better.
It's my autobiography. It's interesting because when I started with HMs and did HM 1, 2, 3, 4, more and more people would look at my products and say, my creations, and say, wow, it's so coherent. And that made me mad, because the whole idea of MBNF was like, I am going to create something completely different at every model. Like, well, basically, every piece we create could be a brand in itself. That was the idea. And when after four or five pieces, they would look at them, and I thought I'd gone all over the place and been super creative. And then you realize you can't escape your own DNA.
Nope.
And that whatever, if I go on down that avenue or that avenue, and if you look at today, a Legacy 2 and a Horological Machine 9, which are two flying balance wheel movements with a differential, in a layman looks at them, he would never, ever see anything in common. But if you know a little bit about watchmaking, you put them one next to the other, and it seems an evidence. I can't escape myself. So for me, it's an autobiography. The whole idea of MBNF is the last day of my life to be proud. Well, that's something I understood 15 years ago, is probably the most important goal of my life, is that last day I look back and think I did well. I remember saying the eulogy of my dad when he passed away, and we didn't get along together, unfortunately. It's probably my biggest regret. But I could say he was a good man. I hope one day, if that day, somebody says that of me, then it will have been worthwhile. So coming back to that, the values, a lot of people ask me, what watch should I buy? That's the horrible question.
That is the worst question.
Because they give you the power. They give you, you're the specialist, you say. And everybody's different. I'm like, just, of course, unfortunately, when you're in independent watchmaking, we're in price points which are way higher than any mere mortal can go to. But it's like, you should first know who you are, what is important for you, and the other point is you should know, try and understand the integrity and the why of a brand, of a creator. And I am so proud when I wear my Kari or my Urwerk or my Stepan Sarpaneva, not only because I work with all of these guys and I love them, but because I know the ordeal they've gone through in their lives to be able to create. And that for none of these people, the business or the money was the goal. This is what they do. This is the only thing they feel they're good at. And they're just writing their story. And they've gone through insane difficulties, like ourselves. I mean, we in 13 years, we had four super rough years where we nearly disappeared at some point. When you own one of their pieces, you know it's not because they were trying to make money. And that's very important for me. Again, that's for me. For most people, it's, oh, look, I'm showing you that I've got a ton of money and I'm wearing that ultimate status symbol. It's not my thing, but luckily there's still people out there who craftsmen and creators, like the people I just mentioned, who create because they love what they do.
Perfect. Well, you know, we're getting close to the end of the episode, and we like to do a little sort of lightning round toward the end of each episode. So I've got a couple little questions here for you. You can answer them as short or as long as you would like.
Okay.
To start things off kind of along the lines of what we were just talking about, what's a watch you've seen recently that really caught your eye?
Oh, wow. It has to be... Of course, it has to be RedChep.
Yeah.
One of the things which makes me sad today in my world is that all of us independents, we're becoming old fogies. I mean, the youngest of us is Felix, I think. Baumgartner is 40 something, because he started so young. And RedChep gives, for me, is the light at the end of the tunnel. There is a next generation out there. What he does is stunning. The integrity we're talking about, the way he works.
And this is Recep Recep.
Yeah, sorry.
Acrivia, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think I actually really like his previous cases, but a lot of people didn't understand his case design and therefore didn't see his movements. But now that he simplified the case, now suddenly everybody discovers what a great watchmaker he is. That also makes it a little bit sad, is that most people need the decoding machines. He's what he does is great. So yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, I have to say the watch he released this year, the Chronomet Contemporain, is I've said it here on the show before, one of my favorite pieces that I've seen in a very, very long time.
It's an incredible watch, for sure.
Yeah.
What's the best place you've traveled in the last year?
Japan. We took 12 days with my wife. We've got two daughters. One is five, one is practically two. And therefore, we haven't traveled much, if ever, over the last 5-6 years. And so it was our first big trip together for a long time. And we took 12 days. And Japan is so fascinating. Yeah, I think it's the only place in the world today, as far as these cities go, where I feel in another world. I feel that if you go now from Singapore to Dubai to LA to Paris to London, it's sort of like copy-paste. And then you go to Tokyo or Kyoto and you're blown away. It was a great trip.
Great.
We've gotten Japan before on that answer.
We have gotten Japan before. Yeah, I feel like that's very on-brand.
Yeah, for sure.
What's the best piece of advice you ever received and who gave it to you?
There are a few battling in my head there. It has to be Günter Blümlein. I was so lucky to be able to work a long time with him. I mean, my 7 years at Jaeger, he would come every 2-3 months. So Günter Blümlein, the man who was heading Jaeger and IWC in those days and single-handedly with a very small team, spearheaded Lange. And he was probably the most brilliant person I've met in the watch industry. And he would come every 2-3 months, and we'd actually spend 2 days together working on all the new products. And one day we're in a strategy or product meeting, and we were presenting I can't even remember what it was. So we would present to him. And he was so brilliant that usually after he started talking, everybody just shut up. And I disagreed with him. I can't remember what it was. And I started debating with him, which nobody ever dared do. And after 3, 4, 5 minutes, I could see he was getting annoyed. And everybody on the table was like thinking, oh my God, Max is going to get fired. And I could be a little bit of a Jack Russell. And so I was like, wah, 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 wah. And suddenly he just stops, looks at me, puts down his heart. He always had these half glasses on his nose. He takes them off and he goes, Mr. Buzer. Oh, shoot. Creativity is not a democratic process. That is probably what has saved me over all these years. And that's why a lot of people ask me also at MBNF, how do you work? How do you create with all these friends around? I mean, if you start asking everybody their advice, oh my gosh, you're going to have the most horrible, boring product ever. So to create what you see, I have to be a dictator. I try and be an enlightened dictator. Meaning I listen to everybody and I take the decision. So yeah, creativity is not a democratic process.
The saying is a camel is a horse made by committee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
What's your guilty pleasure? Do you have a guilty pleasure?
Chocolate.
Okay. Very Swiss answer.
Swiss chocolate is often milk chocolate, and I really don't like that. I like super dark chocolate. And
I'm with you there.
And now, actually, and have you guys tasted this chocolate called Orfèvre? By these two guys in Geneva,
yes.
Caroline and François-Xavier, who've created from bean to bar. Process. They sold everything they had to buy the machines, and they buy now the beans, and they roast them, and they, I don't know all the names, I know them in French. They do the whole process, and they come out with this insane chocolate, it's a bit like us. You'll have on the paper around the chocolate, every single thing they've done to it, the amount of minute they've roasted it, and where it comes from, of course, and blah, blah, blah. And you taste something like that, and then you can't go back to any normal chocolate.
Well, hey. Caroline worked in the watch industry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Caroline and FX, yeah.
Is she still working in the industry at all, or is she full-time?
No, they're more or less, I think they're still working a little bit on their communication company they had.
Okay.
And I buy 25 slabs every month from them.
Oh, amazing.
It's like one a day. It's incredible.
And they sell it in Geneva?
Yeah, unfortunately, they're not online. I keep on pushing them, like, please go online. And they still haven't done it. And it's understandable. And it's very tough for them because, you need to do massive volumes to try and break even.
Yeah,
and that's not what they want to do. I mean, they're the independent artisans of chocolate making. And so, I just want to help them out there because what they do is incredible.
We'll have to get some for the Hodinkee office.
Yeah, we got a third stop in Geneva now.
There you go.
There are now three good things to do in Geneva.
Two chocolates and Mad Gallery.
And the way we close every episode is with a cultural recommendation. So is there something you've seen lately that you want to recommend our listeners check out when they're done with the show?
That's a tough one. There are two books I've read recently. They're probably not for everyone. One is called Sapiens, and the other one is called Homo Deus by the same writer who is... what's his first name? Harari is his surname. He's a Israeli historian, history professor, who basically explains in Sapiens how Homo sapiens basically got rid of every other race of human beings, the Homo erectus and Neanderthals and everything. And from there, you understand how society has become what it is, and you understand everything becomes so clear in what's happening in the world today, by what he explains of how Homo sapiens became what he was. And then his follow-up is Homo Deus, which is his prognostic, and you may be wrong, of now that we've arrived where we are, knowing how we're built in our minds and how we function, how the world could be. And it is sort of just... it just made so much sense, and it just... how do I say... everything I sort of felt in my guts about what I believe society is, I understood it there. So again, not for everyone. Maybe some people's beliefs will be a little bit rattled, but I thought it was a great read.
Great. We'll link up to both of those in the show notes.
Sounds fascinating.
So people can check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I now know what I'm reading over the holidays. So thank you.
My pick is actually a pretty simple one. My guess is a lot of listeners have... you know, been through it when it first came out. It's something that I've started to re-love. Sometimes you come back to an album and it hits you in a different way. And that's Frank Ocean's Blonde.
Yeah.
I think that now that I've been through it, I would say I've been through the album in its totality in the last month once a day. And I think it might be like Dark Side of the Moon for that entire genre. Like it makes so many... here's my tip: is like maybe you know one or two songs, maybe you know Nikes. Go back and listen to like Pink and White or Self Control, and do it with the lyrics. Like pull them up on your phone, or if you're on Spotify, they do the like behind the lyrics or whatever. and actually like read what he's attempting to say, because it's the album is incredible sonically. It's one of those albums where like if I want to hear if a speaker or a headphone's really good, I'll go right to that album. And it's a work of art that I don't think has a parallel within its own genre. I think especially in the last decade, and I know it's a real sweet spot for the Hodinkee crew. And every time I put up a post on Instagram that a song, like, you get a lot of feedback. So I know that people really like it. I'm not giving anybody like an insider's tip. Just if it came out quite a few years ago, and people are still waiting for the big follow up. But go back and if you have some time with a nice pair of headphones or whatever, a quiet moment, put on a song or two. It's next level.
Can I just jump in there? You said people are waiting for the big follow up.
Mm-hmm.
When you create something which is pretty groundbreaking and very different, that pressure,
I can't imagine,
on creating the next one, I can so relate to that.
I can imagine, yeah.
You have to absolutely make abstraction of that as a creator, because otherwise you just burn out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and you've seen it. You can look at parallels with Dave Chappelle, obviously. Mm-hmm. Huge amounts of success and a lot. And you have to assume that as a creative, maybe you were able to create that first thing or even the second thing without that weight. But I wonder how that affects the creative process when that's the weight that's there all the time.
You swap one weight for the other. When you create something which is completely out of the boundaries, you're terrified that nobody's going to like it, and therefore nobody's going to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So that basically you're committing business suicide. You're being happy as a creator, but you're killing your company. And then afterwards, when you start gathering a bit of success, that "I am terrified it's not going to sell anymore" starts going away. But now it's, oh my God, the pressure of all the fans who expect to be blown away at each creative.
The Star Wars paradox.
Exactly. Yeah. And I, in my little way, have to be very careful of not thinking of that, because otherwise I would stop creating.
I can't say it better than that, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's perfect.
Absolutely.
I'm going to recommend another album that's very, very different from Frank Ocean.
Super.
It's this strange record called Oversleepers International, and it's by this band Emperor X, who I had never heard of, and a friend recommended it to me maybe a month ago. I guess it was while I was in Geneva for the Grand Prix. He sent it over, and I become totally obsessed with this album, and it's strange. It's sort of rock and roll, sort of punk, somewhere in the middle, maybe a little folksy at times. The lyrics are really smart. It's fun. It's the kind of thing, certain tracks you want to put on, kind of at night with headphones on, maybe while you're reading something or just relaxing. And there are other songs that are like almost party music. It's super fun, and I've just been listening to it a ton lately. I think it's another one of those things. Some people are going to really love it and shoot me DMs if you do. Other people are going to hate it. Please don't DM me if you hate it. Don't at
it's
me
okay
on this.
Not to like it.
Do not at not me on this one. I think probably like 2/3 of the people listening are not going to like it. But for the third of you who do, it's one of the most kind of esoteric and enjoyable pieces of music I've discovered recently.
Awesome.
So
great.
Cool. Very cool.
Well, thank you guys for joining us. Thank you, Max. I know it's early, and you got a big weekend ahead of you at H10 as well.
Agreed, but it was totally worthwhile. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This week's episode was recorded at Miratone Studios in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week for a series of special episodes live from SIHH 2019.